Good evening, gentlemen. I use the term loosely, of course. My name, Charlie came up to me before the meeting started. He said, I didn't think you still do live meetings. And I said, well, looking at this group, I don't think I'm breaking a streak, you know? Man, I know some of you guys. You got an old. I'm starting to feel, you make me feel so young, you know? I can't believe, look at Tom Quigley. I haven't seen him for a while. I don't know. How many years ago? You must have 7,000 years sobriety or something by now. I don't know what's going on with you. So in any event, it's good to be here. I'm an alcoholic, and I haven't found drinks. Would you do me a favor?
I haven't found it necessary.
Okay, thank you, Lugo. You'll know. I'll tap you on the shoulder. And I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, or have I, since January 25th, 1981. I really think my real spiritual sobriety day is December 25th, 1980, but that's another story, and maybe we'll go into it, probably not, and I'm always left with this decision when I do a meeting like this, especially like this. Do I tell you the truth or just take a nap? And I'll tell you, I could go either way at my age. But anyway, I think I'll tell you the truth. I don't have to. Thank God, one of the burdens that has been lifted from me for a while is the desire to or the need to have you like me, which I think is a more difficult burden than drinking. I think there are a lot of things that are more difficult than drinking. I think if you drink enough, you'll eventually come in here or you'll die. That's my theory. But there may be things worse than death, and one of the things may be worse than death is not ever living or being free or knowing heaven or knowing peace. It may be even worse, as crazy as it sounds. I just throw crap out there just to piss you off. I wouldn't want you leaving here and not thinking about me. It may be even worse to stay sober for 25, 30 years and not ever actually get it. In other words, just sort of like they say in the sixth step, we never settle. Separate yourself from the boys. That's where the great separation is. The sixth step says you can tell the people that are separated because they're growing, they're doing anything to grow in the image and likeness of their creator, and they have an image and they have likeness. It's not the God of their imagination. The God of my imagination always leads me to an imaginary sobriety. So I'm in my 45th year, and I don't, like the old farmer's commercial, he says, we know a lot because we've seen a lot, and I don't really know a lot. I'll tell you what, I've forgotten a lot. And, you know, it says we've got to get rid of old ideas. I've gotten rid of a lot. You know, that's the great thing about getting rid of old ideas. When you clear out all the old ideas, it's clear you can connect the dots and see things. At 45 years, I see things I never saw at 10 years or 5 years or 15 years or 25 years. As a matter of fact, at 40, I see things now that I didn't see last week. That happens, you know. You guys know about epiphanies. When you first come in, everything's magical and everything. Oh, man, I'm not drinking. It's so wonderful. But sometimes as you go up there, you know, in age, the wonder of it all, you're so trapped into the ballyhoo. You know what I mean? You know, the group, the cult, the family, the not drinking, the going to the internationals with the 50, 60,000 people, you know, the whole wonder, the wonderful fellowship we have. But, you know, I think there comes a time, and I've seen it not only myself, I'm only talking about my experience. I've seen it not only myself and other people, that there comes a time, and I think for most people, the time comes at different times. You know, they used to have an old saying here, you know, that pop you hear in 5 years is your head coming out of your ass and everything like that. By the way, there's no strong profanity here, right?
Strong.
No strong profanity.
That's right.
You know, if this was a front line in football, telling me there's no strong sobriety, it's like a gaping hole that I can run through for a cold. But I'm going to be good for sure, because Sheldon gets upset. You know, and I used to have a wonderful sponsor for 20 years, John Glenn, who he sort of got upset when I used profanity. But the Apostle Paul used profanity. Some people, I guess it's the way he used it, some people use profanity to emphasize stuff with alcoholics. Apostle Paul says, I become all things for all men by using anything to bring him to Christ. And, you know, the truth is, it's one of the problems with alcoholics, I think, sometimes with me, is we sort of hear the same thing over and over again. We just, like, fall asleep. And we need, you know, what do we need? We need, like, a cattle prod. We need somebody to say something. That's why sponsors are so good. They can translate a dry sort of deal in the big book into something that, like, slaps you in the back. Some of you guys are old enough. All of you guys are old enough. Remember that commercial where the guy slaps him? Sometimes he says, thanks, I needed that. Sometimes we just need a slap. You know what I mean? Something that just wake us up, you know, that kind of deal. And so I'm probably going to, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do something probably maybe a little bit different. I'm going to tell you about 45 years of sobriety, and I'm not going to talk a lot about alcohol. I probably won't talk much, maybe 3 minutes about alcohol and the rest about the real disease. You know, I'm really, I'm an attorney, and I've read a lot of books. And as a matter of fact, I get paid by the word. And so, but sometimes, like Billy Joel, you got to leave a tender moment alone. And you know, if you ask me, I read the big book. I said it a million times, 12 and 12, a gazillion times. Dr. Bob, the good old thing, gazillion. I read all these books. I had no problem reading the books. And quite, I tell you, I read them all and reading the paragraphs. But you know where I have a problem? I have a problem with sentences. Sometimes you can read a book and say, oh, yeah, I understand. I've read the book 1,000 times, but not quite understand a single sentence. We have a workshop every Saturday. I do a four-hour or four-and-a-half-hour workshop. And we'll read a lot of the big book. I'll throw in some scripture. We'll do different stuff. It's not really an AA thing. It's a recovery thing. And even though we read a lot of stuff, I'll stop and I'll just say a sentence. Just a sentence. You know, Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob, the Good Old Times, is a great book, and I encourage everybody to read it if you really want to know what AA is. I mean, not the AA, not whatever they're doing these days, but the real AA, if you really want to know about that. You know the thing in the book where it says, rarely have seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path? That was written in 1939. The path was something that happened between 1935 and 1939. They weren't reading the big book, by the way. They were reading the Bible. The books they found absolutely essential were 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, and the book of James. And if you asked Dr. Bob what his first things first mean, he'd say, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. All things will be added unto you. Hey, don't blame me. You're entitled to your own opinion, not your own facts. Just tell New York to rip that out of one of those books, you know, because I got that out of conference-approved material. That's what they were doing. Rarely have I seen a person fail who is thoroughly... Well, that's a sentence. Rarely have we seen a person fail. There is one who has all power, that one is God, that you find him. That's a sentence. What the hell you think they meant by that? Half measures avail us nothing. What the hell did you think that? That's a sentence. Let's just talk about that sentence. Half measures avail us nothing. You know, unless you get rid of your old ideas, the result is nil. What does that mean? That's a sentence. Burn the idea into any alcoholic's life. You get well no matter anything, you know? As long as you trust God, clean house. What does that mean? How about the last page? What does it say? It says, but we won't know you in the fellowship. You, Dr. Bobby, says, we can't be sure. God will determine that. But your real reliance has to be on him. He will even show you how to create the fellowship you crave. What do they mean by that? See what your relationship with him is writing. Great events. That's a sentence. You know, you got to read a paragraph. That's a sentence. You'll meet some of us in the fellowship of the Spirit. What is the fellowship? I know what the fellowship of AA is. All you need is a desire to stay sober. It doesn't have to be an honest one. What's the fellowship of the Spirit? God is everything. or he's nothing. What the hell do they mean by that? You know, what do they mean by these things? It's like these, all these sense. So Dr. Bob, the good old times, when he went to 12-step, Clarence, the brewmaster, Clarence Snyder out of Cleveland, who started allegedly the first A group. At least Clarence said that. I think he was saying that after Bill Wilson died, he said that. But in any event, so, and Clarence talked about his, how Dr. Bob 12-step people. And Dr. Bob, what he says, he came in, and he's like 35 years old, he's in a hospital bed. And this is what Dr. Bob says, first line. So what do you think about all this? He says, do you believe in God? First line, right out the gate. So Clarence says what you or I would have said. Well, what does that have to do with it? Bob says, everything. That's a sentence, everything. What the hell do you mean by that? You see, we don't paragraphs. We know how to call it. We just don't know sentences. Well, I guess I do. Dr. Bob says, yes, nothing. You either believe or you don't believe. He says, well, I believe. He says, now we're getting somewhere. That's the, you know, the big book that says, no one has sunk so low not to be cordially welcomed in AA, as long as he means business. What does he mean by that? What do you have to be the mean business? And then, when Clarence said that, he said, okay, now we're getting someone. Get out of the hospital bed and get on your knees. We're going to pray to God to have him come into your life. That's what they were doing before. That's what they were doing. Rarely have I seen a person who has thoroughly followed our path. We're going to pray to God. And then Clarence says this great line. I love this line. He said, I did what I was ordered to do. There were no suggestions. I mean, generalizations are dangerous, especially this one. But pretty much what I've seen is the people that stay sober, you know, alcoholics, our chief characteristic is defiant. The people that I know are going to stay sober, I have a good feeling they're going to stay sober, are people that follow directions and don't argue. I mean, you can argue a little bit like we all do, but I don't argue with people, you know. I just tell them, this is what you do. This is what we do, you know. I'm not going to sit here trying to convince you, you know. I mean, the people that follow directions tend to stay sober, and the people that say things, well, you don't understand, or I'm different, they carry on that bullshit. You know, this is like a self-cleaning oven. Every 2 years or so, the alcohol comes through and just wipes out all the horseshit, right? They go to jail, and they die or something like that until they're... So that being the case, what am I supposed to say to us? And you know, what were they doing? Well, I'll tell you what they were doing. I call it, according to the Dr. Bob, good old times, they weren't handing out white chips. You just couldn't go to an AA meeting unless in front of everybody who was already in AA, you got down on your knees and you gave your life to God before the meeting. That's just a fact. If you really want to know what they were doing. I'll bet the meetings were a little bit. I'll bet you didn't have a whole lot of people saying, well, if they had asked me to do that, I wouldn't have been here. I guess they started off not on the first step. They started off on the third step. But I suppose if you're an alcoholic and you'll get down on your knees in front of 10 or 20 people and give your life to God, I'd say that's a pretty good chance you've done the first step. You're probably going to say, call the program drastic. I'm just starting off by just telling you a little few things that I've learned in life and you know, doing this thing. Not to gain popularity, you know. Dr. Bob was the guy who said to Bill Wilson, he said, let's not screw this thing up, let's keep it simple. Because they both had sort of different programs. You know, Bill had a program from Manhattan, and he was worried about people walking away and laughing at him and stuff like that, which we all do. You know, I'm pretty much a people whore, you know, I want to blend, I want to compromise. I don't want people to think I'm weird or strange or anything like that. And Dr. Bob was unapologetic. The first AA meeting was Dr. Bob putting his foot on a dining room chair rung and reading Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Bill Wilson, meanwhile, was talking to Harriet You know, and he walked up to Harriet. He said, I don't think we should talk too much about God or religion or anything like that. And Harriet said, the only reason you're sober is because of God. And if you won't talk about God, you might as well be the Rotary Club. Now, listen, this isn't crap. I'm just telling you stuff. This is in the material. You know, if you want to read it, you know, it's in the material. I'm just letting you know in case you're 20 years sober, 30 years sober, and you can't understand why you're still worried about money, property, and prestige. And you're still worried about what people think. And I know it's in case we want, one of the things we do on Zoom is we have a lot of meetings. I call them beginners meetings for old timers. You know, when you first got, you know, you see things differently. My perspective changed between 1 year and 5 years. And it changed between 5 years and 10 years. You know, if I took a guy who had 10 years sobriety and I said, Has your perspective about yourself and life changed from when you first came, from when you had 5 years? He'd say, yeah. I said, would you like to go back at five? Would you like to go back to 5 years? Oh, no, that was terrible. If I asked him at 5 years, he said it was great. Now, at 10 years, no, 5 years. To ask you at 20 years, you want to go back to 10? No, no. It was, you know, you grow up and you see things differently, you know, and so that's the deal. I just see things different. See, when I first came in, I went to all the internationals, first five internationals, all this stuff, and I was the Intergroup Backman chairman for 2 years in a row with Clancy Down and Johnny Harris and doing all this stuff and sponsoring everybody and talking. And when I first came in, I thought everybody stayed sober. I mean, you almost knocked my socks off when I saw a guy with 30 years pick up a white chip. I thought once you're sober, you're sober. I mean, sure, you get these guys that have 30 days or something. I never could possibly imagine, because everybody was sober. 50,000 people in the stadium. This is unbelievable. Everybody's staying sober. You know, 5 years, everybody's staying sober. 10 years, everybody's staying sober. 20 years, I'm going to be, everybody's staying sober. You know, 40 years, 45 years, nobody's sober. I look around the rooms. Where are all the guys with 30, 40 years? You know, and the guys with 30, 40 years that I speak to now, they call me up and they're miserable. Bill Wilson in the essay, The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety, said, I've noted, and he had 23 years at the time, because he hit a second bottom, Bill Wilson, after the LSD and everything like that. And I'm not putting him down. This is stuff he wrote about himself. That's kind of what he wrote this. He wanted to write this down. He hit a depression and he wrote down. And what he said was, I've noticed that not only am I depressed and unhappy, and I wrote the book, but I've noticed a lot of oldsters who passed the sobriety test, still my physical sobriety, are not happy with their sobriety. It's funny, at 3.5 years, in the big book, he said, now and then a drinker says, who's not drinking now, says, feel better, look better, have a better time. We laugh at that. We laugh at that stuff, that Sally. We know he's going to try the whole game again because he's not happy with his sobriety. Soon he'll know loneliness as few do. The wish for the jumping off place. And he said that. What's really strange is he said that 3.5, 4 years. And at 20 years, he was there. He was there. So you guys love the stuff he wrote at 3.5 years. You don't look at the stuff he wrote at 23 years or 20 years or what was going on. You know, Bill, Dr. Bob saw it. You know, so sometimes you start hitting that six-step division point. The one that divides the men from the boys. The men being the ones who are doing anything. Their whole life is spent praying and asking God to remove any obstacle between them so they can walk in the image and likeness of their creator. And the guys who are just, you know, picking up medallions and staying sober and trying to manage their lives and keep their jobs and get laid and all that sort of stuff and take some more Viagra, you know, and stuff like that, and in the world and looking at the world and that kind of stuff. And you see, there's a division that goes on somewhere along the line between Alcoholics Anonymous and the Fellowship of the Spirit, which is quite frankly not only confined to AA, it's in AA, but it's also outside of AA. So I digress. So let me just tell you, along the line, I got to speak around, you know, at conventions and stuff like that. And so I kept on. One of the problems I had is when you got years of sobriety, you got all these stories. And I think the secret is in the stories, you know? I mean, I gave you a little history and stuff like that, but what I always think is if you're going to do an Amy, you got to tell on yourself. You got to tell stories. Because the answer is in your story, your own personal. See, you may not believe anything I say, but you can check everything I said in the book and just read the books, but the real answer, they can't say, well, they can't deny your experience. And so, one day, you know, what I was doing is I would have problems. I never really planned what I'm going to say, which you probably figured out by this time. And so what I did was, just for the heck of it, I made a list. You know, people come to me and say, oh, tell the Camaro story or tell the chicken on the roof story. So I made a list of these stories. It was like, when I had 10 years prior, I had like 289 stories. So all I had to do, I'd look at them and say, what story? And I could pick out three stories, you know, and everything, which you least say. And then someone would come and say, why didn't you tell that story? I said, like, it's a 10-minute story. I didn't have time to tell this. You know, you only give it an hour to tell basically this is what happened in your life for 30 years, you know what I mean? And so I got a couple of stories I want to tell you because it has something to do that all the stories have the seeds of the steps in them, have the seeds of the principles in them, you know? And I know if I'm talking to, I have a heart for guys with time that are suffering. I know every group I'm talking to. Look, I love newcomers. I'll help a drunk. But I know every time I'm talking to a group of people, whether it's 5, 10, 15, 100, 3,000, it doesn't matter. I know there's one guy there with 11 and a half years that's going to be drunk in a year and he doesn't know it. You know why? Because I know that. Because I've seen it all over the place. This guy with 20 years who is dying. What's even worse is he can't talk about it because he doesn't even have an idea what's going on. And one of the things that has to do with us is that alcoholics have this profound ability to live miserable lives and tell themselves they're doing okay. I know because I live that way drinking. Miserable life and say I'm not doing so bad. Look at this gal I got. Look at this car I got. Look at this job I got. It's only when you rip all that crap away, you know what I mean, that all of a sudden you're just there and you're looking at the mirror and saying, who am I kidding? We have just a way of looking at things in a perverse, because we're delusional. We can't separate the true from the false. Our alcohol life seems normal. The way we think seems normal. You know, I mean, crap has to really happen, hit us over the head in order to see clearly. It's usually bad crap, which is probably why they have the repeated humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. So I got a story. I have a couple of stories for you. Yeah, I drank because no woman, no job, no amount of money ever worked quite as well and quite as fast as just a few drinks. And I guess if alcohol did for me what it did for me when I was 18 years old, I'd still be drinking it, but it stopped working for me, so I don't drink it. The sad part about my life, it stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me, and I hurt a lot of people. But the truth of it is, even though that statement is kind of true, it's not true. It's true for an alcoholic who has 1 year. It's true for an alcoholic that has 5 years. It's true for an alcoholic who has 10 years. The truth is, no woman, no car, no amount of money, no job works quite as well and quite as fast as just a few drinks. Well, man, that sounds pretty good. And then you get sober and you realize getting laid works just as well. Having a girl works just as well. Getting $100,000 works just as well. Getting a new Rolls Royce, a Rolex watch, you know, getting fit, having women like you, having men like you, having people like you, works just as well as alcohol. And you realize that they said in the Sermon on the Mount and the Book of John that I'm addicted to the world. And once you realize about being addicted to the world and the things of this world, Bill Wilson talked all about this just in emotional sobriety. He says, my problem was dependency. I was dependency on the circumstances and the things of my life. The Apostle Paul talked about this. Do not love the world or the things of this world. How do you not do that? You know? I went in the bathroom. I closed the door. I got on my knees with the big book, locked the door, because you don't want people walking in on you when you're doing the third step prayer. got on my knees and I said the third step prayer. You know what the big book says? We are now finished with the third step. That's what it says. We are now completed the third step. Then I got up and I called the bank and I checked my bank balance. And I checked my bank balance. So it had been ever since. I wanted God and he came. I wanted God and he came, but soon his presence was blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly within myself, how blind I had been. And the drinking, then you learn, isn't even a problem because there's another sentence there. Drinking is only a symptom of the problem. You got 1,000 meetings telling people, don't drink, go to meetings, don't drink, go to meetings, which is important. Don't drink even if your ass falls off. There is no problem so great that a drink can't make it worse, which is important. It kept me sober for 5 or 10 or 15 years. All that stuff, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. Rush, you can screw up anything and be a total whack job. If you haven't had a drink, you're a success. And I needed that, and it helped, and it's important. I don't want you to think it's not important. But what happens when you get to that Bill Wilson deal, when you get to the thing where the worldly climbers is blotted, where you got the steps down, you got everything down, you do give a good talk, but God is not a part of your life. When you have a book that said, what did it say? Each alcoholic, in his own language and from his own point of view, talks about how he developed his relationship with God. What do you do when you have a book like that? That's a sentence. What does that mean? What do I say to a guy who comes up to me at a meeting and says, you shouldn't talk so much about God. You're killing newcomers. When they wouldn't let you go to a meeting unless you got on your knees and talked about God. What do I say about that? Is that the big book? Is that Bill Wilson's sobriety? Is that the big book to compromise? Or is that man telling me, is he really saying? I know it sounds, it says you examine our motives. It says some of our motives are virtuous and some of our motives are selfish, but usually it's a mixture. When that guy tells me not to talk about God in a meeting, is he saying I'm killing newcomers? Or is he really saying it's disturbing me? It's making me uncomfortable. Because if you're right, then I would have to change. And I've settled fine for the way I am right now. I don't know, what is he telling me? If the book says in chapter of the agnostics, if it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life or even the steps, you know, would have, if all this stuff would have helped us, we'd be sober a long time ago. But they didn't help us. We had to find a power greater than us that would solve our problems. And of course we had to talk about God. Of course we had to talk about God. Here's where agnostics have a problem. What do I say when I go to AA meetings and I go for a full hour meeting and everybody talks about their problems and everything, not one person talks about God? What do I say in a, I can do a drunk log. How can I do a faithful log in a group like that? How can I talk about what the real deal is when I'm in a group of agnostics? It says this sort of thinking has to be abandoned. Atheism. What do I say in a group of people that really don't want to talk about it because they think they have elevated the steps to a godlike thing and to Bill Wilson to a godlike thing and to the Fellowship of Alcoholics? Fellowship of Alcoholics doesn't have all power. Bill Wilson didn't have all power. I don't have all power. No, only God has power. What do they mean by that? So I'm sitting in my sitting in my college class. I'm like 21 years old, however old I was, 20 years old, college logic class, and I was going to go for my PhD in algebraic topology. I did all the courses and everything like that. I got A's in it and all that stuff. And this gal walks into my class, and she's got legs up to there. She's a cheerleader. She's gorgeous. And I say to myself, if I only had that gal, I'd be okay. As a matter of fact, it is 100% clear that the only thing missing in my life is that woman. As a matter of fact, I had the same thing. I had the same feeling about that woman as I had about a bottle of scotch. You know what I mean? That woman, as a matter of fact, one of my sponsors, when I said to him in an A meeting, look at that blonde over there, he says, what'd you used to drink? I said, I used to drink, you know, top shelf scotch. He says, you see that gal? He says, yeah, that's a bottle of scotch with legs to you. You know what I mean? And he was right. You know what I mean? I craved that. And I knew that the answer to all my problems was that gal. And so I did what all alcoholics do. I insinuated my way into that woman's life. I insinuated my way into that woman's life. I met her father, who was a doctor. I met her mother, who was a lawyer. I met her grandfather, who was a lawyer. I said, man, this is a group of professionals. You know what I mean? And ultimately, I insinuated into their lives. And I was drinking at that time, but it wasn't like obvious. I wasn't getting drunk all the time, but I was drinking at the time and all that sort of stuff. And I was doing, and I woke up one morning. Remember, I have the mind of an alcoholic, although I really don't think so. I wake up one morning and all of a sudden it occurred to me, I ought to be a lawyer. I mean, what am I doing with this professor of mathematics thing? They don't make any money. Nobody looks up to them. I ought to be a lawyer. And actually, they said I ought to be a doctor or a lawyer. And I went to, and I applied. I had the greatest grades. I applied to medical school. They said, you have no bio. He said, you have physics, you have chemistry, you have math, you have multivariable calculus, you have all this, but you don't have any biology. You got to go back to school and take biology. Now, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I ain't going back anywhere. I'm not delaying anything because I need this guy. So I went to law school. They said, well, you got $300? They said, yeah, I give them $300. I became a lawyer. Okay? And you asked me, well, why'd you become a lawyer, Russell? Why'd you give up all that stuff that you were going to make? And I say to you, and I believe this stuff, because, you know, this is why I say, well, because I've always liked Perry Mason. I like to talk and everything. I like logic. I like being a lawyer. And now let me tell you what the truth is. I changed my entire career, and I became a lawyer so I could get in the gal's pants. Do you understand? Because that's the kind of integrity a guy like me has. You understand what I'm saying? You're laughing. You guys don't know what it's like. You guys would never whore around or give up any integrity you have just to get in a gal's pants. I'm looking at, man, you guys are spiritual, not religious. You're a bunch of spiritual guys, you know what I mean? And I married that gal. We had a baby. We had a house in Miami Beach, and I became a division chief in the state's attorney's office, prosecuting murders and all sorts of stuff like that. And I really loved that gal. It was a great life, and I loved my in-laws, and they were great, and they loved me. And I know what happened. I started drinking over at the Alibi Lounge, and I'd get there at 4:30 in the afternoon. I'd start feeling better as I was pulling up to the bar, and I'd walk up, and I'd have a couple of scotches and everything. And I don't know, the next thing I know, I'd be looking at the gals. After about 6 months, I'd be looking at the redheads and the blondes, because this is what I did. What I did, my whole life was about scoring, about going to bars and getting laid and getting some gal and everything like that. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want you to think that I was, like, successful or anything. You know? I mean, you know, I had as much success with scoring as I did when I got into fights, okay? You know, so it was a two-hit fight. They'd hit me and I'd hit the ground, you know what I mean? You know, but the bottom line is that was my whole life. If I could get a girl, now, I would have not never said this, because all the guys I hung around, like, you know, look at that gal, look at this gal, and everything like that, you know, all the guy was thought exact. Guys in the bar, well, it's just like in here. They think just like I think. You guys think that. I love alcoholics. That's why I love you guys, because you're as crazy as I am. You think the same. So I'm sitting there and I'm trying to score. That's my whole life. And so, so I get married and my wife has a baby. She got a little baby at home and I'm at the bar and next thing you know, I get home at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's after 6 months of marriage, and all I'm doing now, you'd be proud of me. I was proud of me. I never once physically cheated on my wife. I would just stay up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning drinking while my wife is at home with the baby. You know what I mean? And thinking about how I could get that blonde or that redhead if I just wasn't married. If I just wasn't married, if I only had that one, I'd be okay. If I could only do this one, I'd be okay and leave my wife at home without a husband. Nobody ever came up to me in the bar and said, what are you doing here, Russell? You know? I mean, you got a wife, you got a baby at home. What the hell are you doing here? Why don't you go up to your wife? People would leave the bar and say, where are they going? I mean, the booze is here. You know what I mean? What are they doing? And I did that for 5 years for this woman, and then something really amazing happened. Something really amazing happened, you know? My wife one morning came up to me And she said to me, she said, I just want you to know, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. You know what that is? That's a sentence. If you come home drunk one more time, I am leaving you. That's a 12-word sentence. I'm an attorney. I'm trying murder cases. I'm in my blue suit, my white shirt, my red tie, going into court to try a complicated case. And she didn't say it like she wanted to start a fight. It was like she was just dropping off the mail. You know what I mean? Come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. And I heard it, and I was as sober a man. I wish I could say the booze made me do it. Oh, it wasn't with the booze, I'd be a nice guy. The booze made, I hurt more people more ways sober than I ever hurt. As a matter of fact, I've hurt many people sober in AA the same way as I used to hurt them. You know, the thing booze did for me is allowed me to live with my sorry ass self while I was doing it and told me I was okay. So she said that to me, you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you. I get in my car, I'll never forget this. I drive about 3 or 4 blocks and I come to a light. And I think about what she said. You come home drunk one time, I'm leaving you. And I say this to myself. What the hell did she mean by that? You see, we're good with paragraphs. Really not so good with sentences. You see? See, that's the alcoholic brain. What did she? Everything that was important to me or should be important was right on the line. All I had to do was make it home. So that night, I went to the bar, the Alibi Lounge, which I helped name. I'm proud of that. Went to the Alibi Lounge, and I sat at the bar, and I ordered my drink, a double scotch, neat, so I could whack it down, you know, so I could get that place where I really didn't care about what the people thought about me. And Doug Hartman came up to me, a drinking buddy, one of many drinking buddies I had there. You know, we love our drinking buddies. And Doug Hartman came up to me, and I looked at him, and this is what I said to him. I said, Doug, I cannot stay. Ronnie told me if I come home drunk one more time, she's leaving me. And Doug goes like this. He says, he puts his arm around. He says, Russell, I love you, buddy. Everybody loves you. You're the greatest guy in the world. Everybody loves you. Your wife is crazy about you. She will never leave you. And I'm thinking, shit, that's exactly what I was thinking. You know that thing with Doug Hartman putting his arm, I said, that's what I'm thinking? That's the God as I understand it. That's my God. That's my imaginary God. No matter what I do and who I am, I never have to worry about it because he says, you're the greatest guy in the world. I love you, you know? I like that God. I want all my gods to be like Doug Hartman, you know? I don't want my God to get me broke or get me in jail or to cause me to do things where I hurt myself or have bad breaks and misunderstandings. I want that God who puts his arm around me and tells me no matter what I do and who I do it to, I'm okay. That's the God of my understanding. And so, I have another drink, and the next thing I know, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. And the next morning, my wife kicks me out of the house, and that's the end of a 5-year marriage. Lost my wife, lost seeing my son, lost everything. And I wasn't even sorry. You know what I mean? I was too chicken shit to ask for a divorce. But you want to know something? The bottom line is, I could say, well, she threw me out. And if you ask me why I'm getting divorced, I'd say, well, we were different people. We were growing in different directions. She was trying to change me. We got married too young. I had every excuse in the world, and I believed it. And all I knew is I left my wife of 5 years and my baby. I left her because I wanted to screw other women. Because that's who I really am. And I did it cold stone sober. You know what I mean? Now, it gets better. So my wife, who actually believed in things like taking a vow to death do us part and everything like that. Who invented that crap? You know what I mean? Probably some religious guy. Thank God I'm spiritual, not religious. She wanted to try to go to a marriage counselor to try to patch things up. I mean, you know, because she believed in that stuff. And I went to the marriage counselor and he sat there. And the marriage counselor, I'll never forget, he asked my wife these questions. What are the three things you want to change about Russell? I guess it's like a marriage counselor thing. They teach him that. And she was talking. She was saying something, but I wasn't listening. I don't even know what she mentioned, alcohol. I think she might have said to come home for dinner or something. I don't know what she said. But I remember thinking to myself, I have a date with this redhead tonight, and this is screwing up the whole thing. I felt like the movie The Godfather. You ever see The Godfather 2 where he says, I got out and they dragged me back. I felt like I was being dragged back into the cage. And I had a date that night. You know, what is it going to do? I mean, I'm not. And then he asked me, Russ, what's the three things you want to change about your wife? And I said, I just want to date other women. By the way, I tell this story all the time because it's an important story to me. Because I want you to know that I'm not only an alcoholic, I'm an asshole. Is that, does that qualify? What is that? Is that a rough or a, what is that kind of profanity that I'm not going to supposed to use? I'm an asshole.
It's
you know, I had to join, as a matter of fact, I had to graduate into a different fellowship in AA, you know? Because, but I'll tell you about that in a second. I'll try to get through. So that's what I said. And it wasn't until I was 5 years sober where it sort of dawned upon me what saying that in front of my wife, who was the mother of my child, did to her heart, how I ripped her heart about. And I said it without even thinking. It was like just came right out. You know why? Because I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and that's what I wanted to do. And what I learned later on down the road is love, you know, it didn't matter whether I, quote, didn't love her anymore. Love's not a feeling. It's a decision. You decide you're going to love somebody no matter what. You become a man and you use integrity and you decide this is my wife and I'm going to love her and protect her and not be a jack off. You know what I mean? But that's what I said. Okay. And I was cold stone sober when I said it. So the bottom line is a few years then. So I did, you know, my goal was to become the Hugh Hefner of Miami. And it didn't work out so well because you got to be able to stand up when you're Hugh Hefner. You know, you can't be wobbling around. And I kept on drinking. It got worse and worse, like the booze always gets with us. And then what happened is finally on December 25th, 1980, having been kicked out of a party with no woman in sight, all alone on Christmas Eve. And of course, you know, I love feeling sorry for myself. And I knew I was the only one on the planet that was alone. And I became ashamed of what, it wasn't self-pity, I became ashamed of what I had become. And some preacher came on the air, and that's when I got down on my knees and I asked the Lord to come into my life, which I think is what they were doing in the beginning of AA. I didn't even think about that because I didn't know anything about AA. And 30 days later, I stopped drinking, and then 2 weeks after that, I came to the Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm running through, now I'll go through the next 45 years in about 5 minutes, okay? And so here's the deal. So I came to AA. And I did all the things you're supposed to do, and I stayed sober for 10 years. And I got a whole bunch of stories. I got 289 stories, actually, to tell you the truth, about what happened in AA. I remember telling my sponsor once when I was broke. I was about 6 months sober, and I was broke. And I was, and it's not that I don't give a crap. I used to tell myself all the time, you ever tell yourself you don't give a crap what other people think about you? I'd say that out loud. I don't give a crap what they think about me. I constantly tell myself. I usually tell myself stuff like that when I'm really worried about what people are thinking about me. You know, alcoholics tell themselves all sorts of bullshit. So, and I, you know, so I used to tell myself that. And so, but the bottom line is my whole life is about worrying about what you think about me, you know? What do you think about me? What, you know, what do people think about me? What are they going to think about me? What is going to happen to me? One time my house went into foreclosure because of the mortgage crisis and everything. I wasn't worried about losing my wife. I was like, my house, I was worried about what would people think about me if I lost my job or my house? That is the most, you know what that does? That stops you from even talking in AA. Because you filter yourself. Whatever you say, you filter yourself. Because I can't say that. What will they think of? I'm not going to tell my group that I'm broke, that the big shot lawyer doesn't have $50 in the bank. You know? Yeah, I mean, not that I care about what they think about me, but I told my sponsor, Bob Sullivan, I said, look, because I couldn't sleep at night. I said to my sponsor, I said, I don't have any money. I'm broke. I haven't paid the rent in 2 months. I don't know what to tell my wife because I had gotten married again. I don't know what to tell my wife and everything like that. He says, I can solve that problem. I can solve that problem, Russell. I said, really? He said, absolutely. I said, man, I love AA. I love it. You know what I mean? I'm getting ready with my catcher's mitt, a couple thousand dollars coming in, you know. And the meeting was over, and he came up to me. He says, follow me. He says, I'm going to take care of that problem. He says, sure. He says, he starts showing me how to make coffee for the group and how to set up the chairs. And I'm saying, I'm not sure I explained myself well. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm talking about money here. That's not going just right up there with oxygen, you know. And the next day, money didn't come in, and I didn't want to go to the meeting. I didn't want to go to the meeting because the money didn't come in. But I had to go to the flipping meeting because what are they going to say about me if I don't go to the meeting to make the coffee? And so the one thing that used to kill me, worry about people, actually saved my life. 3 months later, the money came in. I was fine. Some guy comes up to me and says, I'll make the coffee. I said, I'm the coffee maker, you know. So I know we're coming to the end of this thing. So the bottom line is, the last thing I'll leave you with, somewhere around 10 or 12 years, and this happened to me at 10 or 12 years. It's happened to people 20 years. I've seen it happen to people at 35 years. I got to a point in my life where I was doing all the work in AA. I know they tell you that the reason people drink is they stop going to meetings. There's a lot of people that drink who are going to meetings. There are a lot of people that commit suicide that are going to meetings. There are a lot of people that are depressed that are going to meetings. Bill Wilson talked about it. There are a lot of people that have a lot of problems going to meetings. You got to do that emotional sobriety. And I got to that point that I hit a second bottom in AA. And I hit a second bottom. And somebody told me, guy come up to me and says, you need to do this. And I immediately explained to him, you don't understand. I'm different. I'm spiritual, not religious. You know what I mean? And he said, fine, do whatever you want to do. And all I know is that a week later, I found myself in Bible study. Go figure. I guess I never read that part where we see where religious people are right. We encourage church membership. I never read what they were actually doing back there, and I find that's what I've been doing. I never stopped going to AA. I doubled my AA, and I doubled my and my third sponsor I found in a Bible study. He had 55 years sobriety. And so that's what I've been doing. And the one thing that added, it added the secret ingredient. And the secret ingredient was, God was no longer a thing or an it or something out there. It became something that I could have a personal relationship with. And I found the more I thought about God, instead of turning things over to God, I lived a turnover life. And so I talk about him at AA meetings. I talk about him at conventions. I think about him all the time. And you know what I found out about this God thing? So I don't know. It has, the drinking is besides the point. What I found out is I stopped thinking about being a whore. I stopped thinking about the money. I stopped thinking about the women. I stopped thinking about cheating on my wife. I stopped thinking about getting the new car or having to have something to put on my body or something to do something so that I look better to other people. You know, I don't know how it works or why it works, but apparently it does. And so that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.